Welcome to Political Rewind. Thanks for being with us today. We understand that an awful lot of you who listen to this show regularly are down in South Georgia and in that area of the state, number of areas of the state, where in some cases you're under an actual hurricane watch, and others you have tropical storm watches. And if you've been listening to GPB radio throughout the day, you know we're staying on top of all of this, bringing you bulletins as we get weather alerts. You can go to gpbnews.org and stay updated on what's happening. I do want to talk a little bit about the storm before we get into the political content of today's show. But let me introduce the panel first. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. Thanks for being here, Greg.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Andra Gillespie, a political science professor at Emory University, is back with a microphone in front of her.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Good. Mary Margaret Oliver, state representative from Decatur, is with us again today. Back from New York.
Back from New York. Had a great time.
Good, good. I wish this weren't a weather-related show because I'd love to talk to you about seeing Kenny Leon's American Son, his brand new Broadway
with
play.
With Kerry Washington.
Yeah,
it was
pretty
wonderful.
Pretty good, pretty good. And Eric Tannenblatt, a longtime bundler. Fundraiser for major Republican candidates from President of the United States, the U.S. Senate, on down the ticket. Hi, Eric.
Hey, glad to be
and
here.
And also, I always forget to say, and former chief of staff for former Governor Sonny Perdue.
That's correct.
Okay. Yep. So the governor at noon today, to talk about this weather situation for just a few minutes, Greg, had a news conference, an emergency preparedness news conference. Talked about how the state is getting ready. What you were there, what can you tell us?
Well, he activated 1,500 Georgia National Guardsmen. He extended the state of emergency to another 16 counties. It now covers about 108 counties, most of South and Middle Georgia and parts of Northeast Georgia even as well now. And said basically get prepared, hunker down. He did not order any sort of mandatory evacuation, said he trusts Georgians to decide that for themselves, but said be prepared and be prepared for extended power loss after the storm, which could cause additional problems.
Just before we went on the air, Tom Faust told me that the hurricane hit landfall near Panama City with winds of 155 miles an hour, which puts it about a mile less than a Category 5 storm. So this is a very dangerous storm, and it's going to move through, as you've been hearing throughout the day on many news reports, is going to move into South Georgia very quickly, Mary Margaret.
With huge devastation to agricultural industry. That's what seems to be our biggest economic threat today. Behind, of course, possible loss of life with a storm that dangerous.
So Lowndes County in the city of Valdosta down in South Georgia is right in the sights of the storm. And we wanted to talk just for a couple minutes to two individuals down there who have been monitoring things, just to get a status report on where they stand. So on the phone with us right now, Ashlyn Becton, who's the public information officer for the city of Valdosta, and she's accompanied by Paige Dukes, who is the Lowndes County PIO. Are you both with us on the phone?
We are. Hey, Bill, thanks for having us. Hi.
So let me start. Ashlyn, if you don't mind, let me just start quickly with you. Can you just describe for us what you're seeing in Valdosta right now? What is that? What kind of rainfall are you having? What kind of winds are you experiencing? How quiet is the city?
Yeah, so we went out about a couple hours ago, and we could already tell that the winds were starting to pick up. And now outside, you can see, you know, traffic lights. We can see them moving and different things. Trees are moving. So we have some strong winds already, and it's light rain for now, but we know that's going to pick up. See lots of folks still out, so we're still trying to get that message out to people that, you know, hey, even though it's not raining really, really hard right now, it's coming. But I know Paige has been sitting in with our EMA director, listening to the latest updates from the National Weather Service, so she can kind of give you a better idea of what's to come.
Paige, when do you are you being told the worst of the storm is going to hit Lowndes County and the surrounding areas in South Georgia there?
Well, as you guys mentioned already, the strength of those bands that we're seeing start to come through look much stronger than what we've seen in the past. I've been covering hurricanes here in South Georgia in Lowndes County for about 20 years, and this is definitely a storm that's a cause for concern. Part of our is that earlier in the week, we thought that the storm was going to get here based on the forecast a little sooner in the day, and everyone did a really good job of staying home this morning. And then, of course, as they have to wait, everyone gets bored and they want to get out, so our traffic is a little more than we would like to see. But we're concerned. We have got, you know, all hands on deck as far as our manning goes, and everyone's out. So we're just really, really waiting, but we're expecting some substantial winds. We could have gusts in excess of 75 miles per hour in the northern part of our county. We saw around 60 with just a couple of gusts that were recorded at our airport during Hurricane Irma. And we had thousands of people without power for several days. So that's kind of what we're facing probably tonight and tomorrow.
One of the things that's happened here is that this storm has hit everybody somewhat by surprise. There was very little advance word on it. It moved up through the Gulf and gathered speed very, very quickly. Paige, how has that affected your ability to prepare in Lowndes County?
Well, here in Lowndes County, we really stay prepared all year long. Historically, not just tropical storms and hurricanes, but we just have the potential for a lot of tropical weather that can move through here. So we were prepared. September was preparedness month. That was a good focus for all of our departments and for our community to look at being prepared. It's just that by this time in the season, you know, we're looking on to other things. It's very unusual for us to get this type of weather on into October. Really, we usually feel like that once we've made it through September that we're clear for the year. We had really no tropical storm activity this year up until now. So we really are thankful for all those smaller storms that we had last year and some other events that, you know, again, you kind of hope for the best and plan for the worst. And whenever you really don't get hit, it's a great training exercise for the entire community.
Ashlyn, one quick question for you before we let you go back. I know you've both got a lot of work to do. You know, it's interesting. Greg Bluestein, of course, just reported that the governor did not want to order any mandatory evacuations. That's always a tricky call. It's a political, to some extent, politicians pay a price when they do one or the other, yes or no. But so the fact that he did not declare a mandatory evacuation, in Valdosta itself, do you see people taking that storm very seriously? Are they hunkered down? Have some left the area? Are you expecting the kind of problems that you wish some people would leave or would have left?
Definitely. Well, we've got a shelter open, and I know this morning we had about 65 people. We encouraged anyone in substandard housing, mobile homes, RVs, things like that. We've got a lot of that in South Georgia, a lot of housing that, you know, we encourage people to go to shelters, and they do, just because we've seen just recently in the past couple of years some storms come in, and I think people have seen the effects of them so much that they really do adhere to these warnings. So when we open up these shelters, we always get people coming in. But that is a hard call to make. I know to pack up your family and leave, but a lot of people do make that call. I know we still have hotels open here, so we know that people have left the area.
All right. Ashlyn Becton, Paige Dukes, we are thinking about you and all of your fellow residents of that part of the state of Georgia. So we wish you a safe passage through the storm. Thank you for being with us for a few minutes on Political Rewind today. Let's do this. Why don't we get our first break of the show out of the way right now, and we'll come back. And as I said, if there's news to report about the storm as we move forward, we will give you that. But let's take a break and come back and talk politics on Political Rewind.
This fall, we're counting on the participation of everyone who listens to cover the rising costs of the programs we bring you on GPB. If we didn't hear from you during our fall fund drive, there's still time to support the programs that make a difference in your life. Please take a moment now to make an online contribution. Go to gpb.org and click donate at the top of the page. Your contribution at whatever level is right for you will help cover the costs of the programs you love on GPB. Thank you so much for your support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
We're back on Political Rewind. Greg, let me turn to you, if I may, to start things off. You're about to release at the AJC your second poll of this gubernatorial campaign season. I think it's going to be published tonight or tomorrow.
Tomorrow it will be published, and it focuses on the governor's race, Trump's approval ratings, and we have some down-ticket candidates we also polled for the first time.
All right. Well, can we talk about a different poll for just a couple minutes?
Of course.
Okay.
Chad, I want a preview.
I do too. All right, let's go after him. What are you going to show us?
I wish I could. I don't have the numbers yet.
Yeah, a likely story. Now he sounds like some of the politicians who come on this show. Greg, the 11 Live Survey USA poll was published yesterday, and it, like the other polling we've seen, it's a dead heat, basically, within the margin of error, 47 to 45 with Kemp a little bit ahead, but again, within the margin of error. White voters are backing Kemp in their poll by 3-1. African-American voters, 17-1, breaking for Stacey Abrams. But there are a couple things in here that are particularly interesting. Surveys USA found 18% of independent voters say that they are undecided. That's a much bigger number than the total universe we've seen of undecideds in other polls that have come out. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, the basis for each of these candidates have firmly moved over toward the candidates. So you have in poll after poll after poll, 90-plus percent of Democrats backing Abrams, 90-plus percent of Republicans backing Brian Kemp. And it's leaving that smaller sliver of undecided voters still up for grabs. And in the AJC poll from a couple weeks ago, there's only 7% undecided. I bet that number is going to dwindle. But that means that those undecided voters, those independent voters who haven't quite found a home yet, are still up for grabs and still waiting to hear something from the candidates that could appeal to them.
All right. So let me throw this out. Andra, let me bring you into the conversation here. Surveys USA also suggest that when those undecided voters are asked to make a choice between Kemp and Abrams, they break significantly for Kemp rather than Abrams. Now, you know polling as well as anybody. Mm-hmm. What should we make of that larger percentage of undecideds? And what should we make of this notion of where they're going to go with their vote?
So this one was interesting because the break is different than what we've seen in previous surveys. So the last time I was on here, we were on with Mark Roundtree, and so his were flipping in the other direction. It's important to understand that the margin of error that is reported for the overall survey is very different than what the margin of error looks like for the subgroup. Now, the Survey USA poll had a larger group of independents, and in terms of folks who were undecided, it was just, this group was roughly about 120 people. I think it was 120 in the survey. Of the independents. And so that margin of error is actually huge. And so basically, I would need to see a difference between Kemp and Abrams of about 40 percentage points. Actually, I think maybe smaller than that. In order for me to be able to say definitively that that's telling me anything. So I'm going to chalk this up to sample size and then just kind of let that go. Understand that there's a lot of statistical noise there.
Okay.
I'm always curious, and Andrea, you are an expert. When people say they're independents, are they telling the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, in this hyper-emotional climate, which I perceive to be hyper-emotional at this time, how does that impact polling?
Well, I mean, so here's where people who are self-described independents are. I actually believe that the number of independents is staying relatively stable in this country, and it's actually a really small percentage of folks who are truly, truly independent. So in survey questions, when we ask party identification, when people say that they're independent, you usually follow up with a question about, okay, so do you lean Democratic or do you lean Republican? When I see that question or when I am working with data, I take those people who claim to be independent but will acknowledge leaning one way or the other. I put them in the same category as partisans.
Okay.
And the thing about all of these surveys is that they're not terribly clear. And I literally asked people at 11 Alive about this yesterday. I was like, okay, so where did the leaners go on this? Because I can't tell from this. And so what I suspect, because this is a larger group of folks, is that you actually have a lot of leaners who are sort of being counted in that group. So
which
if it's
makes
not
it meaningless.
Well, it makes it just harder to decipher. It would, it would make more sense for me to do it there, but I'd have no proof one way or the other that that's what's going on.
Eric?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think that the people are saying they're independent this year, probably more so than other years. But I do think because Georgia, at least historically, has been more right of center, you probably have more of those independents that lean Republican but are saying that they're independent. And I think that the actions of the candidates right now are sort of determining how those people are split. You know, for example, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about this later, but, you know, Elizabeth Warren coming in for Stacey Abrams, while that energizes her Democratic base, which is really important and she needs that, I think it will take some of those leaning Republican independents and move them more towards Republican, because Elizabeth Warren is such a lightning rod for those that are on that lean more Republican.
One of the other things we're watching for in these polls is Trump's approval rating. And there's another poll from the public policy polling.
Is that right? Which firm, is a pretty liberal organization.
A left-leaning firm that showed Trump's approval rating of around 50%.
In Georgia.
In Georgia, which is much higher than the AJC's UGA poll had 2 weeks ago at about 41%. So watch as these polls, you're seeing his disapproval ratings stay around the same, you know, at 50, 51% in most of these polls. But if Trump's approval ratings start to rise some more compared to polls just a few weeks ago, that's another sign that there could be more Republican energy, not just around, events like Elizabeth Warren coming in town, but also Kavanaugh.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to see what your poll says tomorrow, but the change there with regards to the president, because this is just completely anecdotal. I have found that those more independent-leaning Republican voters, the Kavanaugh nomination has really moved them into more solid Republicans. So
Republican messaging is that Kavanaugh helped the Republicans. That's coming out of the mouth of every single Republican talking head and senator, whatever.
No, but you feel it. I feel it, too. Not just what I'm hearing the talking heads
say. I'm feeling something different. I'm feeling a
lot. From Republicans?
From my crowd. From
right.
Democrats. I'm feeling a real anger and energy, and this can't be happening again.
Right, so it may be energizing both sides.
I think at best it's going to energize both sides, or worst.
So I don't want to weigh in on this debate. I kind of want to go back and just correct myself and actually have the actual Survey USA numbers here. Because when I said this to myself, if you're dealing with a sample of 100 people, that margin of error is plus or minus 10, which means that it's got to be something greater than 20 percentage points in terms of the difference in order for it to matter. And in this one, though it is going in the opposite direction of what we've seen before, it is a 17-point difference.
A 17-point difference
between Kemp and Abrams amongst independents in the survey.
Okay,
right?
That's
pretty. But the margin of error is plus or minus 9, which means it has to be greater than 18 in order
All right. So I recognize. Let me do this. Let me put a period on this portion of the conversation. But doing it this way, it is very difficult on radio without the ability to show you graphics to really grasp this kind of data. So, Greg, let me say this. And you correct me if I'm wrong. The Surveys USA poll tells us very much what other polling has also shown us, which is the race right now between Kemp and Abrams is very, very close. Abrams right now, according to Survey USA, is getting about 25% of the white vote. That's certainly the threshold for what she needs of white voters if she expects to win. And she's getting more than 30% of the African-American vote and certainly needs a bit above that. So this race is a horse race, and it's those independent voters who are going to determine
And actually more than 90% of the African-American vote, which she wants it to be more than 30% of the overall electorate.
Well, that's what I meant, was the 30% of the overall electorate.
Exactly. And as you look at these polls, just keep watching for that. The number of undecideds is going to continue to dwindle, and look at the floors. 45-45 was the AJC poll a couple weeks ago. Now we're seeing more polls show them at 46-47%. It's a very narrow race. But remember, keep in mind, Stacey Abrams' entire campaign is built on transforming the electorate. She's always going to say these polls are not going to accurately reflect her support because she's trying to expand the universe
and
of left-leaning voters.
And Andra is the only one at this table that probably understands this enough to talk intelligently about it. But my greatest fear, no offense, gentlemen. My greatest fear is that the dead heat electorate is going to result in the Libertarian getting at least 3 points, and that's going to dictate a runoff.
We're
going to
head for
nightmare,
a December 10th runoff on
which
that
is my
basis.
Nightmare.
I mean, I think that that's a possibility. But in terms of sort of how pollsters should weight their surveys and prognosticate, most of them are looking at about, or they're hitting it, or they're weighting it to be about a 30% black electorate, which would actually be an increase over
Michelle Dunn.
Midterm year.
Yep.
And that's actually smart. I mean, I think it's wise. So, I mean, if Stacey Abrams could get black turnout to be 35% of the overall total, that's great. Right, she wins. But when the polls, no pollster in their right mind is actually going to sort of like set their demos to that, because like that's the, you know, you want to be conservative in making these estimates and you want to hedge your bets. And the reality of it is that all these surveys have 600 to 1,000 people. We're only going to be so accurate in actually being able to predict what this actual number is going to be.
All right. I don't want to bury the lead. I mean, Mary Margaret just introduced the topic that we ought to at least spend a couple minutes on. Eric Tannenblatt, this race, if it remains this close, and who knows, I mean, the polling is a snapshot of the moment, not a prediction of the outcome. Are we headed for a potential runoff here?
Well, if you take the numbers we're just talking about, and Representative Oliver is correct with regards to the Libertarians going to get a percentage of the vote. However, I just feel like as we get closer and closer to the election, this is going to break. And I think Brian's going to edge it out. Now, I'm sure you're going to disagree with me. Mm-hmm. I think it's all about energy, but I think that that's what's going to happen, and we'll avoid it.
Greg, are the campaigns talking runoff quietly with you?
Quietly. I'll say this too, though. The Libertarian 4 years ago, Andrew Hunt, was a vocal. He didn't have much money, but he was a vocal presence. He was out there. Ted Metz.
Haven't heard from him at all. Yeah.
Just zero. And I don't know how much that affects, but poll after poll usually has the Libertarian at 2%, which is within the statistical negligible margin.
I've heard an accidental vote is 2 to 3%. And if you're energizing young people tend to be, in my Emory Decatur community, tend to say they're more Libertarian. I'm really nervous about a runoff.
All right, let's move on to, Eric already brought it up, Greg, that we had some powerful visitors in our state yesterday for each campaign. Elizabeth Warren and Ayanna Pressley were both here in Metro for Stacey Abrams and, of course, Donald Trump Jr. and his paramour.
Paramour.
Kimberly Guilfoyle, the former, Andre just really cracked up when I used that word.
No,
but
I'm
if I said
right
girlfriend,
now,
you would have been upset with that.
No, I wouldn't have actually. I would have just said girlfriend. I think that's actually more neutral than paramour.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Right. All right. So they were out there. And you know, I made this point yesterday. You could not ask for better contrasts for these people coming. You could not ask for a more perfect difference between the surrogates who were here for these candidates yesterday. You were at UGA with Donald Trump Jr.
And I was with Senator Warren in the morning.
Oh, you
too.
Were?
So
wow.
It was. I got the bookended day between progressive hero Ayanna Pressley and Senator Warren, who was one of Trump's most vocal critics, and Donald Trump Jr., who is his father's most ardent defender, maybe. And I got to see the crowds for both, a big, huge crowd at Clayton State University, packing to hear not just Ayanna Pressley and Elizabeth Warren, but also Stacey Abrams speak. And it was a lighter fundraiser for Brian Kemp and Donald Trump Jr., but there was about 150 people up in Athens hearing the typical talking points from both parties.
And what did you come away thinking?
Kavanaugh was a specter in both speeches, more overt in the Democratic speech, where Elizabeth Warren said this was let's turn our pain into power. Truly trying to energize Democrats to turn this into a pivotal point in the election. Trump Jr. didn't mention it as overtly in Athens, but said essentially the Democrats are trying to find any controversy they can. Even if his father came up with a policy of supporting oxygen, they would oppose it.
Yeah. You know, Eric, a week before the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, the second hearing, I would have said, or I would have asked, whether it makes sense for Brian Kemp to keep something of a distance between himself and Donald Trump, considering the negatives that we see Trump has had in much of the polling on this state, and that would apply for Donald Trump Jr. That would apply, I guess, not so much to Mike Pence, who's here tomorrow. But the The aftermath of the Kavanaugh hearings and the confirmation seem to have shifted things a bit. I just feel that now Trump has positioned himself again as someone who Republicans who might have been a little nervous about him now are embracing again because he's so aggressively promoting the Kavanaugh hearings as the way in which Democrats were demonizing Kavanaugh. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and again, I'll be interested in the poll Greg was talking about, but it's what I said earlier about anecdotally, I feel the same way. I have felt that Republicans are all rallying around the party as a result of the Kavanaugh hearings, just like Representative Oliver said the Democrats are doing on the other side. But I think it is true. I think that there has been a shift within the last, you know, week to 10 days.
Mary Margaret?
What does it say about the Republican electorate if they respond positively to the President of the United States mocking a sexual assault survivor? What does it say to the Democratic electorate that senators are calling the Me Too demonstrators a mob, a dangerous, threatening group of mobsters? What does that say to people who care about being civically engaged in politics in America?
Yeah,
what's the message?
I could recite things that were said on the left by some of the, you know, potential 2020, you know, liberals that want to run for president, just like, you know, what you recited. I just think that there is a view among Republicans that the Democrats overplayed their hand. And I'm not talking about my personal views. I'm just saying what I feel out there is that there is a movement towards rallying around the party that the Kavanaugh confirmation has ignited.
Well, in surveys last week, one of the things that I think sort of speaks to Eric's point is when they were asking folks how enthusiastic they were, they did actually see an uptick in Republicans reporting greater enthusiasm in this contest than last time. And that it doesn't exactly predict, but it's used as one of those signals or markers that we might see higher Republican turnout than people had thought perhaps a couple of weeks beforehand. There is still sort of, and in a state like Georgia, which, you know, the fundamentals are going to privilege Republicans, like, you know, that could mean the difference between winning or losing a close election. There's still the larger national issue about Democrats being ahead on the generic ballot, which also portends actually a shift in terms of control in politics. And so I think we also have to sort of take them in mind that sometimes we're talking about enthusiasm for turnout, and then we are still talking about sort of the case-by-case, race-by-race things where there are places where Democrats are ahead and there are places where Republicans were coming in with an advantage.
And I think you have to look at Georgia in the context of the country. So a lot of what was just stated is how things look nationally. And true, there are states in the country where the Democrats are doing better, especially in the congressional elections. But we still are a right of center state, and we're not as right as Tennessee, where you saw an 8-point swing in the Senate race towards Marsha Blackburn. But we still are a right of center state, and I think you're going to see in your poll tomorrow. Maybe I'll be wrong.
That was before Taylor Swift weighed in on the Tennessee race.
And there has been a surge of new voter
64,000.
Apparently, that's right. Apparently, Taylor Swift's Instagram, passionate Instagram about supporting Phil Bredesen, the Democratic candidate for Senate, former governor of the state, over Marsha Blackburn, has apparently energized young voters. But in any case, Mary Margaret, so here's my question for you about this. I get that Republicans were as angry as Democrats were. There's no question. Andra just mentioned that we saw that as we looked at the polling. But there's still 3 weeks to go until the election, and they won. They won. Do they have any? Does that motivate them really to go to the polls the way it does Democrats who are now angry about losing that fight with Brett Kavanaugh?
I think not. prior to this very surprising election, where the pollsters were all wrong, of course, for the election of Donald Trump.
They were and they weren't.
The most consistent attitude that both Republicans and Democrats had was a dislike for Congress. I think that the dislike for Congress, the dislike for the Senate, it was exacerbated by the Kavanaugh hearings and the Kavanaugh painful, painful, distressing dialogue about where women stand as a individual who wants to talk about being a victim. I think that it is totally unknowable to me, and I think it may be unknowable 3 weeks and 6 days out, as to how the younger voters who really are being challenged to vote this time, how they're going to respond to the nastiness and the disrespect that Congress showed last week.
Well, I mean, so part of it is just mobilization and standard GOTV. So if both sides are
get
doing
the
their
vote.
Job, yes.
GOTV.
So if both
Thank
sides
you.
Are calling people, knocking on doors, getting them to turn out to vote, we know we can marginally increase their likelihood of turning out to vote. And so if you're worried that people might just be kind of, you know, turned off by this, then that just is another effort to redouble one's efforts to go tell people, hey, no, seriously, you need to vote. And I think that that's probably what you heard in some of those comments by the celebrities yesterday, was that they were trying to say, look, if you're angry about this, the right way to channel your energy is to, you know, make your voice heard at the ballot box.
Greg, you get the last word on this.
And their arguments were made to those younger voters that Representative Oliver was talking about. And I'm really fascinated to see how that turnout will affect the race, because more than 1,200 students, mostly students, showed up at UGA for the Donald Trump Jr. main event at the Classic Center. And Stacey Abrams, a couple hours before that, announced her own event in Athens for Thursday. So you're seeing them try to, you know, amp up their efforts to reach out to these college students who they need to vote.
All right. Eric, you made a comment that I think, and Andra, you also referred to this, about the difference between what we're seeing nationally and what we're seeing in local races. I want to park that for a minute, because we're going to come back to it. We're going to talk about how this is playing out in congressional races here. But before we do, while we're talking about candidates who are on the statewide ballot, I want to talk a little bit about this Sarah Riggs Amico story that came along the day before yesterday. Greg, she was talking at a campaign event, and she seemed to be kind of talking off the cuff.
She was talking about the role of the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, she talked about, here's why the lieutenant governor is more important than many people think. And I want to play a portion of what she said and then throw it open for a conversation. Here's Sarah Riggs Amico on why the lieutenant governor's role is so important.
I always call it, like, you know, the most undervalued office in state government here in Georgia. Many people understand that, God forbid you ever need it, there is succession. So if the governor is out of the state, you're acting governor, or if, God forbid, they're removed from office, you become the governor in succession. And I would say normally that that's probably a very unlikely event, but let's be honest, if we had Governor Brian Kemp in sort of the Me Too era, I'm not sure that guaranteed he'll make it 4 years, or scandals, or what have you. I mean, stuff happens.
Greg, where did that come from?
Yeah.
I know she feels that the video and the audio were cut short. She went on and described other things that could push a governor out. But she talked about Me Too and Brian Kemp.
Yeah, and really, I mean, Brian Kemp has focused on his marriage throughout the campaign. His wife Marty has figured prominently in his campaign messaging. So they take this as a deep insult that you have a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor questioning basically his fidelity.
It does feel like a terrible misstep, Andra.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's because we're trying to figure out exactly what she's talking
about,
that we don't know anything about.
Exactly. Is she talking about anything we don't know about?
Well, I mean, I don't know. And so I think that that's what makes this weird. I don't know if she's trying to reference the stuff about the massage parlors again. But I mean, again, I don't see how that would take him down, because it wasn't like he was at the massage parlor.
I think it could have been referenced to the massage parlor issue, which is the licensure issues for the bad dentist and the bad I used to be a hearing officer for those boards, so I know about there's some terrible cases there. It could have been that. It could have been a misstep. It could have been the fact that he employs a secretary of the state, I don't know how many hundreds of people, and that there's an employee issue under his broad management. But I certainly have no information, no rumors even about a specific Me Too instance that specifically relates to him.
Right.
I think it's a cheap political shot by a political novice, and I think utilizing things like Me Too for political purposes is disgusting.
And just before we got here, to echo Derek, Julian
I'm sorry,
Thompson,
Eric. How do you feel about this?
No, I really do. I think there's some serious things that have come to light in the Me Too movement. But I think using it for political purposes is disgusting, and it shows that she's a novice.
Just before we got here, to echo Eric, we heard from conservative activist Julianne Thompson, who's often on this show, who had about 50 names of grassroots Republican women who all said essentially the same thing. And Julianne's quote was, this has intellectually insulted Georgia voters.
She said, here's the whole quote, in Sarah Amico's desperate attempt to obtain name recognition, she has intellectually insulted Georgia voters. Brian Kemp is a good man. He's a man of faith, a husband, and a father. Mary Margaret, does this have legs?
I can't know. I do know that the messaging coming out of the Republican leadership and the messaging at all levels is attack. These women are just, are not to be believed. They're mean, they're mobsters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's consistent with the national message that women should not be talking about being a victim. If you talk about a victim, that means you're weak. That's the message that came specifically from Donald Jr. yesterday or something.
But I'm glad you said that that's the national message. If you look at the state leadership in this state, the Republican leadership, you don't hear Johnny Isaacson, you don't hear Governor Deal, talking about that.
Well, David Perdue
let's
tends
talk.
To be a little bit more in the Trump camp when it
no,
comes to that.
No, you will not hear
sort of
Johnny
thing.
Isaacson saying that, or Nathan Deal. I certainly agree with that. But there, my ears are listening a little bit more closely. I think the insults that are coming from the Republican leadership are significantly mean-spirited.
So let me weigh in and then ask you about this, Andra. So regardless of Republican or Democrat, anything that cheapens or degrades this whole notion of women coming forward to acknowledge their history of sexual assault, sexual harassment. And in this case, it feels like unless she's got something she wants to reveal to all of us, Sarah Amico throwing that out rather frivolously does no good to the whole cause, the Me Too cause.
I agree. It doesn't. It also doesn't do good for her.
Yeah.
And I think that this is important to point out. I mean, when charges like this come out, they should be taken seriously. And that's the whole point of Me Too is to take them seriously. And so I think there's a certain responsibility to not throw out baseless charges. I would say that even when people do that, and there's always going to be somebody who does that, that doesn't mean that when the next person comes forward that you disbelieve them because somebody else was a bad actor
right.
in that type of situation. So I think that, that's important to point out. I mean, I think I'm willing to agree with Eric that this is a rookie mistake on her part. It's, and it's a potentially troubling one. What I think she was trying to say was, in the event that the governor can't carry out his or her duties, who do you want in second place? So she's trying to make the Sarah Palin argument, but she's doing it with an opponent whose running mate is young and healthy.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the reason why that was an issue, which is usually not an issue in vice presidential and presidential sort of teams, is because the candidate that she was running with was old and had a history of health issues.
All right. So, Eric, I've covered Georgia politics for 35 years, and I don't know the answer to this question. She, and you should, because you were a chief of staff for a Georgia governor. Is that right? When the governor leaves the state? That's another thing she said. The lieutenant governor doesn't take over when the governor's out of state.
No, and actually we have a former candidate for lieutenant governor. That's not true.
Yeah, I was surprised by that part of the remark.
Casey Cagle didn't exactly take over for Governor Deal every time he went overseas.
If that were the case, Deal would have never left Georgia.
I should know the answer to this. I don't apologize for not knowing the answer to it, but I don't think we have anything like a 25th Amendment here in Georgia.
No.
I think that it's The taking over by the lieutenant governor would result, I think, in most people's minds from a significant, unexpected health disaster.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's safe to say that if Sarah Amico has a chance to reflect upon that day, I think in Dalton was where she was.
LJ,
that's right. She wishes that day had never happened and she could start over. All right, let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way and come back, talk about congressional races right here in Georgia. You're listening to Political Rewind.
If you recently supported GPB during our fall fund drive, thank you. We're already putting your dollars to work to bring you the programs that matter to you on GPB. If you didn't get a chance to donate during the drive, your online contribution now will still make a difference. Please take a couple of minutes to go to gpb.org and click the green donate button at the top of the page. Thanks so much for your generous support of GPB and the service we provide every day.
On the next Fresh Air.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal of landing a man on the moon.
We talk with Damien Chazelle, who directed the new movie First Man, about Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon. Chazelle also wrote and directed La La Land. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're in the studio with State Representative, Democratic State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, Republican insider Eric Tannenblatt, Andre Gillespie from Emory University, and Greg Bluestein, AJC political reporter. A couple quick items. Number one, again, for those of you who haven't heard by now, we're going to be in Savannah on the 30th of this month. You can sign up to join us there if you'd like to be in the audience when we broadcast, when we record the show. Just go to gpb.org/community and sign up. If you didn't get a chance, you know, we're going to do the show next Monday night in front of an audience here in Atlanta, but I'm told that has really, that's sold out by now. And by what I say, sold out, tickets are free, but apparently all the seats are accounted for. So don't even look for that one online. I don't think it will be there. Then I wanted to remind you all that Friday, our next show, Stacey Abrams will be here live in the studio. Jim Galloway and I will talk to her about her campaign. And I want to point out that we invited both Kemp and Abrams and made the same offer. And the Abrams people said yes immediately, and the Kemp campaign said they don't have time to come in here and be part of the show, which is disappointing to us. We're sorry. I actually saw Brian Kemp here in the building the other day and said to him personally, I wish you were doing our show, Brian. And he said, look, she has a 9-week head start on us. We had to go through a runoff. We're trying to catch up as quickly as we can. But sorry, he's not going to be here, Greg.
Yeah, it's disappointing to me, too. And apparently there was a little bit of an eternal debate over there about whether to do it. But I will say he does have something like 3 bus tours this month. He was all over the state last week. He's got 2 more bus tours. So he was in Athens for about, it seemed like an hour and a half yesterday before he had to go to another event after the Donald Trump.
Yeah, I don't, you know, there was a time in my career when I would have gotten all huffy about that, about this. At this point, I get it. There are other things besides being on Political Rewind that matter to campaigns. All right, let's move on. So, Mary Margaret, we continue to see the data crunchers, 538, Politico, Nate Cohen, everybody's continuing to say that in the generic matchups for the House, that Democrats still have a much better than even chance on 538. It's a 4-5 chance at this point, I think, for Democrats to take the U.S. House. The thing is, though, as Eric and Andra alluded to earlier, we're not running a national congressional battle here in Georgia. We've got a couple of Democrats, 2 of them up in the North Metro area, who feel they've got a chance. But the same people who are saying Democrats are going to retake the House are not giving great odds for either Lucy McBath or Carolyn Devereaux to beat their incumbent opponents.
In this highly gerrymandered state, the Democrats are relying on the changing demographics, and specifically the changing demographics of suburban Atlanta and the diversification. I think Carolyn Bordeaux is running an extremely smart, well-financed, very thoughtful campaign. I saw her first TV ad last night that I thought was just excellent. Ms. McBath is a nationally focused, there's a lot of focus nationally on her. I think these suburban districts are very, very pivotal in the national discussion. I'm glad that all the commentators seem to take it for granted, whatever we can predict, that the House is going to flip. And they're not count. They're going to flip without these two seats in congression in our 6th and 7th district. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. It's a very interesting political science debate going on with two different but very interesting and very well-financed candidates.
Andra?
So if it's a tidal wave, so the difference between a wave and a tidal wave. If it's a tidal wave, then one or both of the 6th or the 7th could possibly come.
What does that mean? What's the difference?
So we could be talking about sort of barely hitting that 23 seats that the Democrats need in order to take over, maybe even going like 30, 35 seats. Or we could be talking like, you know, a 94 type of thing, you know, where you
when
got
Newt Gingrich,
when Newt Gingrich takes over and where you're talking about a more than 60 seat swing. And so if it's like 94 and it's a tidal wave, then, yeah, the 6th and the 7th are probably in that. But if it ends up being a little bit more narrow, and most of the generic ballots have the Democrats up by about seven points.
Seven or eight, yeah.
So and I use Alan Abramowitz's model. And so at 7 points, he's predicting, don't quote me on this, but it's on Larry Sabato's crystal ball. I think the number's at about 35 seats with about a 7 point swing. So if you have like a 7 point Democratic generic ballot advantage. And so so what people like Nate Silver are doing is they're looking at races one where there's a lot of polling available and we just don't have a lot. Then we don't have public polling for the 6th and the 7th. And they're also looking at districts that ideologically actually might be more conducive to having a flip. So open seat contests are always going to be easier. Seats that, you know, places where you have an ideological moderate who's, you know, representing the wrong party based on sort of what the demographics of the district represent. Mm. Those are actually easier seats to flip than even the 6th or the 7th district, the changes in the district notwithstanding. So, yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense that there is some caution about assuming that the 6th or the 7th would be the first to flip. These are races with incumbents. These are races with novice candidates. You know, these are races where the demographic changes haven't come full circle yet.
This is not inconsequential beyond just those congressional races, Greg, because the 6th and the 7th and the voter turnout there and the composition of that voter turnout could weigh heavily on who wins the governor's mansion, too.
And what's interesting to me, and I don't disagree with what Andres, who is the expert here, what she said, but I do think that it's relevant that we have many, many local contested races in Gwinnett and that what I call the outer perimeter districts. The 32 endorsed Wynn women all are running, many of them, following those races very closely. Every single one of those local races in Gwinnett and Northern Fulton and Cobb that's putting forth a very strong Democratic campaign in either an open or a contested House or state Senate seat is going to help Carolyn Bordeaux and Lucy McBath.
Yeah, in the 6th district alone, you mentioned that in the 7th district, there's five or six really contested seats, one for state Senate and four or five House seats that are supremely competitive. In 6th district, there's multiple House seats that
Fran
are very
good.
And Fran Miller in the Senate has a very tough fight on his hands. There isn't much polling, but here's what we know from, and you have to take this with a grain of salt, but the internal poll from Lucy McBath showed a close race, of course, but it also showed that roughly two-thirds of the voters in that 6th district race could not identify her.
And that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, Greg. Eric, the McBath people were excited to report. They've now sent out their third quarter financial report, and they say they raised $1 million mm-hmm. in the last 3 months. If they've got an identification problem, they have some money to try mm-hmm. to fix it.
Yeah, and it's out-of-state money that doesn't represent voters.
Oh. Green.
And I also think your point is a good one about, you know, wave versus tidal wave, where I don't see a tidal wave happening in Georgia. I think we need to recognize that nationally, the reason why the House is in looks like it could potentially flip. I mean, we've had more Republican retirements than Democrats. There have been more open seats. Both Karen Handel and Rob Woodall are not open seats. They're very, you know, well thought of, thoughtful lawmakers. I think they're running good campaigns. I do not see it happening. Look, I think it's all about energy, and I know that you want these legislative, the turnout to be, you know, high in these legislative races. It's going to, you know, it'll help Macbeth in Bordeaux, but I think at the end of the day, Georgia is not national, and I think we're not going to have a tidal wave, and I think both of those incumbents
will
get reelected.
So I'm assuming, Andra, that this notion of a tidal wave has to do with the fact if you can win as many as, say, 50, 60 seats, it tells you the entire country is energized. They're determined to put Democrats in office, and you would expect to see that reflected in the turnout in Georgia races. Is that just essentially what it comes down to? Because obviously people who vote in Arizona or California don't have any impact on us, but it says something about the appetite to put Democrats in office. Is that what a tidal wave means?
Well, I mean, so when you see that type of seat swing, what you would expect to see in the national polling leading up to it is a double-digit margin for sort of intended Democratic vote.
Yeah.
Right? And so, and for the most part, we don't see that. There's a CNN poll yesterday that said that there was a double-digit margin, but like every other poll says something different. And so if that's the case, it would show up sort of in the national mood type of questions. And so the national mood favors the Democrats, but it's not favoring the Democrats in such a way that we still won't have very narrow margins in the House, you know, when this is all said and done.
Mary Margaret, you're going to be out there. You've been very active in the, I think, in Carolyn Bordeaux's campaign, if I got that right.
I've been helping lots of candidates, and I'm excited for them. And she's one of them. I just like her resume. I like Gilbert Kenny. I like the way she's campaigning. I like her TV ads. I think she's on a roll.
Well, Greg, if Mary Margaret Oliver has her way, she'll win up there.
That's going to be a close one. It's going to be, and we've talked about this before, but if it was just Gwinnett County, Carolyn Bordeaux would probably have this in the bag, but because it has half of Forsyth County, which is ridiculously conservative, 80% plus.
It also Trump has vote. A large international population of professionals, though. It's an interesting, if you look at the South Forsyth High School in terms of all the academic awards there, it's an interesting, changing place.
All right, we are just about out of time. Greg, when, you know, Eric said, or I think it was you, Eric, said we don't have any polling of these congressional races.
It was Greg. Greg said that.
No, yeah. Oh, it's Andra. Could we possibly see a polling of those congressional races?
Those types of races are even more expensive than normal to poll.
But you're Cox Communications. You've got money to burn.
Maybe once they sell WSB.
Right, okay. Listen, we're out of time for today's show. Before we do leave you, though, one announcement I did not make is, you know, on the night of November 6th, we're going to be here at GPB Radio throughout the night. We'll be anchoring the show from right here in this talk studio, and we'll stay with you until we hope we get a conclusion to the gubernatorial race. We're going to do an hour on TV at the very beginning of the evening. We'll have more details about that as they become clear to us. So stay with us for that coverage. Mary Margaret Oliver, glad to have
you.
Eric Tannenblatt, Andra Gillespie, Greg Bluestein, thanks. See y'all on Friday at 2 with gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams.